Welcome to the political scene. I'm Michael Luo, the editor of NewYorker.com. Since Donald Trump's election in 2016, there's been an almost constant feeling of emergency in American democracy. The January 6th committee has been holding hearings and making clear to viewers just how close we came to a violent overthrow of the 2020 election. Election deniers are winning important midterm contests across the country. And we're coming off a shocking Supreme Court term in which the court lurched rightward, overturning the constitutional right to abortion and issuing a series of monumental decisions on guns, environmental regulation, and the separation of church and state. You might think that these are completely disparate political events, but researchers have begun to understand that we can actually think about all of these together as part of a broader cultural, religious, and political phenomenon, one that is rooted in a specific reading of American history, and in particular, Christianity's role in it. They label this concept white Christian nationalism. Samuel Perry is an associate professor of sociology at the University of Oklahoma and has written several acclaimed books that look at the relationship between conservative Christianity and American politics. Hey, Sam, thanks for joining me today. I'm really excited to talk with you. This is a really important conversation.
Well, thanks so much for having me. It's really important, like you say.
So, Sam, you're the co-author of two books about a phenomenon that you call white Christian nationalism. I'd love to start with some basic definitions. What is white Christian nationalism? And maybe just as important, what is it not?
Sure, that is a crucial question. And so we define Christian nationalism broadly as an ideology that seeks to idealize and advocate a fusion of American civic life with a very particular kind of Christianity. And this is where the whiteness comes in. So that particular kind of Christianity is not Christian orthodoxy. It's not loving Jesus necessarily. Sometimes it's not even identifying as a Christian per se. It is a particular kind of white Christian ethnoculture. It means traditionalist, conservative. It means pro-Christian. And all of the other things that we would assume, like natural-born citizens as opposed to immigrants. And so it's very much about insiders versus outsiders. So white Christian nationalism is that ideology that seeks to institutionalize that kind of understanding of Christianity within American civic life, within our policies, within our sacred symbols, within our self-definitions, and more so within our judiciary and how we think about laws. Now, what is white Christian nationalism not? So we try to go to great lengths to distinguish white Christian nationalism from a couple of different things. We don't believe Christian patriotism is the same thing as white Christian nationalism. In other words, you can be a Christian, you can be a patriot, you can be a Christian and vote your values. Religion is going to shape how you think about politics and how you think about policy. We also try to distinguish white Christian nationalism from white evangelicalism. White evangelical identity is partly political, but it is also, I think properly understood historically, a theological tradition, a group of people that believe that you interpret the Bible a certain way, that you hold some kind of orientation to Jesus Christ and the gospel. And yes, white Christian nationalism, there is significant overlap between white Christian nationalism and white evangelicals. And yet we feel like it's inappropriate to conflate the two and to say that to talk about one is to talk about the other. You can be a white evangelical and oppose white Christian nationalism. And I think that's an important distinction and something that I think we've tried to do since 2016, when Trump was elected, everybody was talking about white evangelicals. That was just the every headline. And I think what we've tried to do is we've tried to steer the conversation away from that group of people and that religious identity to more the ideology that we feel like drives their support.
Sam, let me ask you a personal question. There's so much of your research relates to Christianity and history of Christianity and its intersection with politics. And I'm curious about your own religious background, your own church affiliation, and how that affects your research. Do you go to church?
Yeah, so I'm speaking about this movement as an insider. I grew up in the evangelical church. I have a seminary degree from an evangelical seminary. My parents are evangelicals. My in-laws are evangelicals, and so this is very much me talking to my people about the kind of values and the political views that they embrace. And yet, at the same time, like this when I say that not all evangelicals embrace Christian nationalism, I'm speaking it to my own reality as a person, but also to my parents and the example that they set for me. Even if I weren't somebody who goes to church consistently, somebody who is, that's a part of my life, I would hope the evidence and the data would be enough to convince me that this is a bad thing. You know, you don't have to twist my arm when I say that this is inconsistent with the kind of values that I would like to see representing Christian communities.
What kind of world do Christian nationalists or people who adhere to this ideology want to build? What's their end goal?
Right. So at its most fundamental, Christian nationalism, white Christian nationalism in particular, believes that the nation has always been and should always be defined by our own people like us. America was founded as a Christian nation on biblical values with this very conservative, traditionalist, and evangelical, in a sense, understanding of biblical interpretation, very traditionalist, conservative. And white Christian nationalists believe that that is the key to our prosperity. By faithfulness to that ideal, America has become strong and successful economically. And moving away from that will cause us harm. And so there is this deep story about America's past, but also this vision for its future. And the vision for its future is one in which white Christian ethnocultural values and ideals and people like us call the shots. We set the policy agenda. The symbols represent our values. And so this is where it gets into nationalism. It's this idea that outsiders, those who would both come in from other countries, but also the outsiders within, the leftists, the socialists, the seculars, those who are from minority religious groups and those racial minorities, whether intentionally or unintentionally, they, by their very presence and influence, seek to corrupt the very things that made America great. And so white Christian nationalism is about going back to that mythical time where we were prosperous, we had the right values, we had the right views. And so we see, policy-wise, white Christian nationalism is strongly associated with authoritarian forms of social control. It is strongly associated with anti-democratic views on, say, voting and rights. And it is also strongly associated with the idea of persecution and conspiracy, that people are out to get us and we need to respond with force, if necessary, to take back our country.
How many people are we talking about here?
Yeah, so in our studies, we try to quantify this and see, okay, what percentage of Americans embrace this to a strong degree? Remember, we talk about Christian nationalism as a scale. So this is it's a bit difficult. We have to arbitrarily, okay, like who is a true believer of Christian nationalism? Let's say that's Americans who fall within the top quartile of the Christian nationalist spectrum. Those are the true believers. In our previous book, Taking America Back for God, we call these ambassadors of Christian nationalism. There, we're talking between 15 or 20% of white Americans who embrace this to some degree.
Wow, that's a large number. And then you said it's a spectrum, so how far out did that circle expand?
When we're thinking about the categories that we use to just place people on this spectrum, on the far left end, we've got these people we call rejectors of Christian nationalism. This is about 20 to 25% of Americans who say, you know, they strongly disagree with just about everything we ask about Christian nationalism. They don't want to have anything to do with it. Then a little bit closer to the average, you have these people we call resistors. These are a little bit more friendly. They're not so just adamantly opposed to it. They understand that, you know, religion and politics is a little bit complex. On the other side of the average, you have the largest group that we call accommodators of Christian nationalism. This makes up about a third of Americans. And so these are the folks that most of them tend to be Christians. Most of them tend to be, you know, pretty friendly with the idea of, say, prayer in public schools or religious symbols on the courthouse lawn or a cross on the state seal or something like that. They just don't see much of a problem with that. But they're not willing to erase the separation of church and state. They're not ready to say, yes, the government should declare us a Christian nation or the founding documents are divinely inspired. They're not willing to go that far. I think these are moderates. These are people that are Christians, that are not willing to embrace Christian nationalist ideology so completely. These are the people that I think are uncomfortable with, or at least can be made uncomfortable with the implications of Christian nationalism, if that makes sense. If I can explain to them, like, look, Christian nationalist ideology is something that is associated with all kinds of negative things that you don't want Christianity to be associated with, and help them understand that this is just a negative path. one of the positive developments we've seen within the last few years, and we've seen this in data from the General Social Surveys, and Pew has published data on this as well, and so has PRRI, and we've seen it in our own surveys, that Christian nationalist ideology, in terms of a percentage of the population, seems to be declining somewhat. That is both good news and bad news. The good news is, you know, I think as older cohorts are being replaced by younger cohorts, a secularization takes place a little bit slowly. You have fewer and fewer Americans who want to embrace this. Maybe as we've had conversations about Christian nationalism in the public, more people are backing away from that and recognizing that this is not something that they want to sign on to. The bad news, however, is I think with a diminishing percentage embracing this ideology, you have greater purity and greater militancy and potentially radicalization. And really an increasingly accurate perception on their part that we are the minority, we are going to be persecuted, we're going to be targeted as the people who are the outcasts and the outsiders. And with that, you have greater agitation for work and change. And they are actually having a lot of success right now. Like their strategy has paid off in really big ways. And so they're not going away anytime soon.
You know, you mentioned the purists, the true believers. And maybe this is a good time to talk about January 6th. One of the shocking things when we were covering it and watching the images, and our own Luke Mogelson filmed a video from the Senate floor when the insurrection was going on, and there were people praying. There was Christian imagery everywhere on signs. What is the connection of Christian nationalism to January 6th, the storming of the Capitol? What is the connection?
I'm so grateful for that video footage of that prayer. I've almost memorized it, like what the QAnon shaman was saying at that moment.
Actually, just for people who didn't see that video, just to jump in, that it was a guy, the QAnon shaman you mentioned. He had a bullhorn or something like that, and he was praying on the Senate floor.
That's right. And so I think within his prayer, you actually see an encapsulation of the ideology that we're talking about. In his prayer, he thanks God, he thanks his Heavenly Father for filling that chamber with patriots that love you and that love Christ. So he's praying to Jesus. This is not some kind of like a fringe thing. This is a kind of prayer that you would hear in a Pentecostal worship service. And he thanks God for allowing them to send a message to all the tyrants and the communists and the globalists that this is our nation, not theirs. And he thanks God for allowing America to be reborn at that moment. I mean, this is the kind of understanding that they thought that they were accomplishing at this time. This was the goal. And in our recent book, The Flag and the Cross, we start with January 6th as something that seems radical and fringe. And from a certain standpoint, it was. Like you don't have a high percentage of Americans who are ready to storm the Capitol at that moment. In terms of its expression, that was radical. But the underlying ideology that we saw on display on January 6th is not fringe. It is actually held by a large percentage of Americans. This idea that America is ours. It is ours and not theirs. And that the tyrants and the communists and the globalists are trying to take it from us. That there is this conspiracy, that there is this leftist conspiracy to try to wreck and to crush our group and our values and people like us. And we've got to take it back by violence if necessary. That is, we feel like that is a real clear indicator of the kind of ideas that we're talking about, the conspiracy, the appeal to authoritarian violence, the anti-democratic impulses. Those are all indicative of the underlying white Christian nationalist ideology that we describe.
This is actually an important point, connecting Trumpism with white Christian nationalism. And I think it's confused a lot of people initially of why so-called evangelicals would support, you know, a presidential candidate that maybe embodies debauchery, multiple marriages and that sort of thing. In your book, The Flag and the Cross, you write MAGA is a secularized and reactionary form of Christian nationalism. Can you elaborate on what you meant on that?
This is something where we think Christian nationalism is actually going, is actually headed in the United States. And Trump was really a jumping off point or either an indicator of where it was going or really the catalyst, maybe both. But Trump is really, and MAGA, Make America Great Again, is really the secularized It's devoid of any kind of Christian piety. Like there's no really need to love your neighbor, to live like Jesus, to be Christ-like. That's not the goal. The goal is to win. The goal is to win the culture war. And I think more and more post-Trump, we're seeing the mask come off, so to speak, right? There's no need to dress this up in terms of loving your neighbor or the greater good. It really is just culture warring, us versus you. And now culture war that is morphed into just outright political war. And, you know, if the left hates us, good, we hate them. And, you know, this is not about evangelizing. This is not about, you know, a good public witness for Christians. It's just devolved into this kind of secularized ideology that even non-Christians can embrace.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit newyorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
Let's talk about the Supreme Court. There's, of course, the Dobbs decision overturning their right to abortion, a nearly 50-year-old precedent. But there was also, less publicized, a decision affirming the right of a high school football coach to pray at the 50-yard line, a decision that favors religious liberty over the separation of church and state. There was also a big ruling on guns and gun control. Are we seeing the court becoming a vehicle for Christian nationalism?
I mean, I think you can look at who is celebrating those decisions and you can see this has absolutely become the case. I mean, that was the strategy from the get-go. Evangelicals, not just evangelicals, but people who subscribe to Christian nationalism, when we would ask them in various surveys, say in 2020, when we asked Americans, what are the most important issues to you? We found that the more you subscribe to Christian nationalism, you are actually more likely to say that the Supreme Court justices were the greater factor in your vote than, say, even abortion. Right? Why? Well, it's because it's if you get the Supreme Court, you get it all, right? It's not just about abortion, and it's never just been about abortion. It is about making sure that as society changes, as the demographic changes, as we become the increasing minority, as white people become less the majority, they have less political power, as Christians have less political power, we need to promote and sustain situations in which we can rule from a minority position, and that is through the Supreme Court. And so appointing Supreme Court justices has been the ball game for a long time. And what we're seeing now is consistent judicial decisions in favor of what they would call religious liberty or, you know, religious freedom, or in the Dobbs decision, flipping it back to the states, which is also consistent with Christian nationalist ideology.
There's obviously a lot of different positions that are held by people adhere to Christian nationalism that seem to be in obvious conflict with basic Christian beliefs and values, the gospel. And one of the more puzzling ones for me is on guns. And we talked about the Supreme Court and this big Second Amendment decision that they handed down. It would seem to be in tension with beliefs about the sanctity of life. But you argue that to Christian nationalists, the Second Amendment may be the most treasured right of all. Why is that?
For those who embrace Christian nationalism, white Americans in particular, they believe that, one, there's a couple of factors going on. One, they revere the Constitution in an almost biblical kind of sense. They believe it's divinely inspired, not at the level of the Bible. I don't want to put, you know, I think that would be a mischaracterization, but they hold it in high esteem in the same kind of sense, that it shouldn't be altered, that it should be interpreted originally. You know, with a constitutional originalism is very much like a Christian nationalist view, that it shouldn't be amended with very few exceptions. And so with that becomes kind of a reverence for things like the Second Amendment. But they're selective, right? So there's only a few. Like when we, I'll give you an example. In a recent survey, we asked America, we just gave Americans the Bill of Rights. We just listed the Bill of Rights and we said, which right is the most important right to you? Now you would think white Americans who subscribe to Christian nationalism would say, well, freedom of religion, of course, right? Like that would be the most important one. Maybe even, after that would be freedom of speech or something like that. We found that the more Americans who subscribe to Christian nationalist, white Americans who subscribe to Christian nationalist ideology, they valued the Second Amendment above all of them, because they believe, and I've actually heard this kind of rhetoric, that the Second Amendment is the right to bear arms is the right that guarantees all the other rights. In other words, our access to violence, our access to guns, to protect ourselves, to protect our own rights, is the one that guarantees all the other rights. That is really a very, very Christian nationalist understanding of how you think legitimate access to violence works is people who have the right values, people who have the kind of the authority to do that, should be able to suppress chaos and deviance, outsiders, people who are up to no good, which is why we find similar patterns in, say, white Americans who believe that the authority should be able to use any means necessary in order to maintain law and order. This is also connected to, the skepticism. Christian nationalism is very skeptical of any claims about police brutality or violence against African Americans or George Floyd, of course, those kinds of things. Because they believe that, police should be able to use that kind of violence. It's a violent place. It's a violent world. And so, you've got to have people with authority to be able to exercise that kind of righteous, good guy violence in this chaotic place we live.
Are there leaders of this movement politically? Are there elected officials that you've been watching for their connection to Christian nationalism?
Well, so Trump is clearly the leader, but that's because Trump is a winner. And Trump is the guy who makes the promises and has been able to fulfill those promises. I think people dismiss Trump as this kind of lazy and distracted autocrat, and in many ways he was, but when it counted, he produced, he was able to appoint the justices that he did, and he didn't take crap from the left, right? Tony Perkins, CEO of the Family Research Council and a politician, lifelong culture warrior, was asked by Politico in 2018, why do you guys give Trump a mulligan on things like Stormy Daniels and this kind of unethical sexual behavior? He says evangelicals, and I think he's talking about Christian nationalists here, but he said evangelicals were tired of getting pushed around by Obama and his leftists, and we were glad somebody was on the playground who was willing to punch the bully. And that is exactly what Trump represents for the Christian right. And so I think political leaders are now on the right. They are advertising themselves as those who will also go to bat for conservative Christian values. And so you see minor players in that who are very loud, like Lauren Boebert or Marjorie Taylor Greene. I think one guy who was trying to be this was Josh Mandel out of Ohio. And I think J.D. Vance will probably emerge as trying to play the same kind of rhetoric. At different times, you see Josh Hawley or Tom Cotton or formerly Mike Huckabee, Wendy Rogers out of Arizona. I mean, you do see, Mastriano in Pennsylvania. I mean, it's just out there, right? And I think The New Yorker has written on this several times. This guy is just unapologetic in his embrace of this. So you do have, from a political perspective, minor players, but together they make up this, I think, a loud movement that is becoming, it's becoming mainstream, in other words. And in decades past, this wouldn't have made a lot of sense. You would alienate a lot of voters. But in this highly polarized context, where the goal is, and because of gerrymandering, the goal is really to primary your Republican opponent by appealing to the base as hard and fast as you can. You have a lot of people, I think, who are trying to do that, to be as radical far right as possible, to draw attention to themselves, but also identify themselves as the warriors on behalf of this very scared and very angry Christian audience that wants to say, okay, who's going to stick up for us? Who's going to punch the bully, the leftists, the seculars, the people who are coming after our freedoms and our liberties and, all those kinds of things.
Doug Mastriano is the Republican candidate for governor in Pennsylvania. You can't get more mainstream than that, and it has a real chance to become the governor of Pennsylvania. I wonder if we can actually, this is a really dark picture that you're painting. I wonder if there's any room for hope. How do you go about countering the effects of white Christian nationalism? Does the answer lie inside the church, outside the church? Do you see any glimmers of hope?
Yeah, I've become more and more convinced that we need broad coalitions of people who are willing to put aside differences in order to confront the threat. So I think it's going to require both insiders, especially, but it's also going to require cooperation from a broad spectrum. And I appeal to the, you know, Jonathan Haidt talked about years ago. He talked about something called the Asteroids Club, where if we knew that an asteroid was headed towards the planet, we would hopefully put aside our petty differences in order to cooperate and to confront this common threat that we all face. Now, I've become more skeptical of that because COVID was that asteroid and it just polarized us more. That's a, you know, that's a really sad reality, but ideally, best case scenario, things like COVID, things like global warming, and I believe this global threat of authoritarian populist movements and Christian nationals, white Christian nationalism in the United States is one of those examples. Hopefully we would all, a best case scenario that you've got evangelical never Trumpers on the right and you've got people at the Freedom From Religion Foundation who are willing to link arms and to say, like, let us come together and confront this very real threat in the United States of this authoritarian populist movement called white Christian nationalism. I think that can happen. I think the fact that we're having these kinds of conversations, and I want to have them more to be able to point to that threat and to say, like, hey, this is not who we are as Americans. But we also need insiders. We need conservative Christians, and we need pastors, and we need seminary presidents, and we need Christian authors, and we need Republican leaders who are willing to put their feet down and to exercise some political courage and to say, like, this is not who we are. This is not democratic. This is not American. And this is something that is antithetical to the kind of nation that we want to build. We also need these Christian leaders. Now, I think I say that, and I hope to be optimistic. At the same time, there are reasons for pessimism even there. As we enter this hyper-polarized context where everything the left criticizes, conservative Christian leaders feel like they need to embrace. Even yesterday, I saw it bouncing around Twitter that Al Mohler, who's the president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, is a very influential evangelical. He, in a speech, he had said that the left is calling me a Christian nationalist, as if that's a bad thing, right? Like, he's almost embracing the label. The more that happens, the more conservative Christians embrace that label of Christian nationalist, and it becomes just a part of their identity. I think that just spells disaster. That's just horrible news. I mean, we want to talk about Christian nationalism as this thing that is anti-Christian, un-Christian, anti-American, and noxious, not something that evangelical leaders are racing to kind of double down on and to embrace as their identity. The only hope that we have, I think, is in cooperation and insiders having the kind of cultural and political courage to speak against it.
Do you think Christian nationalism is a threat to the church?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think it hollows it out completely. So I'll give you an example of that. So Pew Research Center, and I love the data that they're putting out. They're doing really valuable work. One of the findings that they've had within the last year is they looked at white Americans and whether they identified more or less with the identity of evangelical within the last 5 years since Trump. Now, a lot of us would assume that white Americans would just be abandoning that label, white evangelical, over the last few years just because of Trump and how he's just probably his reputation dragged that through the mud. But they actually found that kind of an increasing percentage of white Americans subscribe to evangelical identity. What's going on? Well, when they looked at who identified, they found that it wasn't people who were necessarily becoming more religious, but it was people who had previously been Trump supporters. And now all of a sudden they realize that, okay, to be a religious Trump supporter means to be a white evangelical. So they were actually embracing that term. So think about that. You've got a larger percentage of Americans that are identifying as white evangelical, not because they love the Bible or love Jesus or go to church, but because they consider that just a Trump supporter. That's their political identity. For white evangelicals, that ought to terrify them because that means that your group is not characterized by your piety, your faithfulness, but it's characterized by your political identity and your values and the leaders that you support. And I think there's other indicators that when all of this becomes about pure culture warring and it just becomes political, I think the spiritual aspect of your own religious identity, something you claim to value above all, becomes hollowed out and really replaced with another kind of worship, that of power, that of influence, that of authority, and I think this is harmful, tears apart the church, but I think also erodes the church from the inside.
Sam, this has been a fascinating conversation. I just really appreciate it.
Well, thanks so much for the opportunity. It's a privilege to talk.
Samuel Perry is an associate professor of sociology at the University of Oklahoma. His latest book, co-written with Philip Gorski, is called The Flag and the Cross: White Christian Nationalism and the Threat to American Democracy. I highly recommend it. It's a short book, so important. This has been The Political Scene. I'm Michael Luo. The show is produced by Michelle Moses and Kylie Warner. Our theme music is by Russell Gillespie. Thanks so much for listening.